Well, as you're enjoying your dessert, you'll get an extra helping of interesting stuff. So we're here to talk about regulatory barriers to innovation, where they exist, when, if ever, they're appropriate, and how to break them down. But before I introduce the panelists, let me answer the question that may be on some of your minds. Why is a federal regulator here moderating a panel about regulatory barriers? In addition to having sort of an up-close view of some of these barriers, in fact, the FTC has frequently focused its antitrust and economic expertise on the problem of regulatory barriers. And we've been a frequent advocate for lowering such barriers or abolishing them where appropriate. So Dean, in the introduction, touched on some of the work the FTC has done, and I hope the panel will also touch on some of those things. But we have an exciting panel here to discuss regulatory barriers. I'll introduce each of them briefly, and then they will give opening remarks, and then we'll have a panel discussion with time for Q&A at the end. So I'll introduce all of you, and then you can give your remarks in order. So Clark Neely, from the Institute of Justice, is here. He joined the Institute of Justice as the senior attorney in 2000. He litigates economic liberty, property rights, school choice, First Amendment, and other constitutional cases in both federal and state courts. Clark has represented entrepreneurs and property owners across the country. In his private capacity, he represented the plaintiffs in District of Columbia versus Heller, a historic victory for Second Amendment rights. Clark also directs IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement and authored the book Terms of Engagement, How Our Courts Should Enforce the Constitution's Promise of Limited Government. Clark received his undergraduate degree and law degree from the University of Texas. Next, we'll hear from Krishna Juvati. Did I say that right? Okay. From Uber Technologies. And I can't throw stones. Olhausen is not an easy name to say or spell. So. Krishna is the director at Uber Technologies, where he oversees all regulatory matters in the United States and works on new ride-sharing products such as Uber Pool, Uber Assist, and Connect. Krishna was the primary architect of the ride-sharing regulatory framework that has been adopted in over 50 jurisdictions around the world. He opened up airports, which is a very important venue for ride-sharing companies, by negotiating a permit with the San Francisco International Airport in 2014 that has served as a model for other airports. Krishna is a graduate of the UCLA School of Law and Northwestern University. Next, we'll hear from John O'Neill. Dr. John O'Neill is a professor and director of the Center for Hospitality Real Estate Strategy at Pennsylvania State University. He previously held management positions with Hyatt and Marriott in a variety of cities. He holds a PhD from the University of Rhode Island, an MS from NYU, and a BA from Cornell. John is the author of a book on hotel market analysis and valuation and has authored many peer-reviewed and professional articles on related topics. And then last but not least, we have Peter Pitch from Intel Corporation. Peter is the Executive Director of Communications Policy and Associate General Counsel for Intel Corporation. Prior to joining Intel, Peter was the President of Pitch Communications, which represented telecommunications clients before the FCC and Congress. Peter has served in senior positions in the federal government, including as Chief of Staff to Chairman Dennis Patrick of the FCC, Chief of the FCC's Office of Plans and Policy, and Attorney Advisor to FTC Commissioner Cal Collier. Peter holds a BA in economics from the University of Chicago and a JD from Georgetown. So each of our panelists will provide some brief introductory remarks, and then, as I mentioned, I'll lead the Q&A discussion. So Clark, take it away.
Thank you, Maureen. It's a pleasure to be here, and this is maybe the most important thing going right now, innovation policy, and I wanted to start by saying that I think it may surprise many of you who actually makes innovation policy in this country. It's not who you think it is. I'm going to keep you in suspense for a moment. But the identity of who really makes innovation policy in this country is both surprising and troubling. And I'll get there in a moment. I want to start with the quote that most of you are familiar with from Emerson. You may not have heard the entire quote, and it's rather elegant, so I'll read the whole thing. If a man can write a better book, preach a better sermon, or make a better mousetrap than his neighbor, though he build his house in the woods, the world will make a beaten path to his door. Well, what happens in America when you build the proverbial better mousetrap? Well, what happens is that your neighbor, if he's also in the mousetrap business, he doesn't make a beaten path to your door. He makes a beaten path to the state capitol with lobbyists in tow so that he can get a law passed to make your new mousetrap illegal. And that's who makes innovation policy in this country, is incumbents with lobbyists. You've probably heard the joke before that any competent prosecutor could get a ham sandwich indicted. I would add to that that any competent lobbyist could also convince the legislature to create the Department of Licensing ham sandwiches. It is incredibly easy to get anti-competitive regulations passed at the state level, and again, that is by and large who sets innovation policy in this country. It is incumbent industries, incumbent businesses that do not wish to compete with innovators. And the question essentially is, do we have an effective means of resisting that, or do we have a system that enables innovators who are genuinely bringing a better, cheaper, more efficient product or service to market to resist the anti-competitive efforts of the incumbent firms? And the question is, not really, but maybe. I'll get there in just a moment. I want to talk about two different ways in which particularly states respond to innovators in a way that discourages innovation and in a way that's not beneficial to the public. The first is with actual targeted policymaking. In other words, they actually pass a law that is specifically targeted at the innovator. There's a case going on in Texas right now that some of you may be familiar with involving a new business called Teladoc. And Teladoc is a company that delivers medical services through non-personal visits to a doctor. In other words, you don't go to a doctor's office. You can actually FaceTime or use other video apparatus to have a consultation with a doctor and then receive advice and perhaps a prescription or whatever treatment you might need. It's innovative, it's efficient, it delivers high-quality medical care to people who might not otherwise be able to obtain it. Texas is a big state, so there are places in Texas where you might have to drive for a whole day to get to a doctor, so basically it's win-win for everybody. So who didn't like it? Well, incumbent doctors didn't like it, and of course, since they control the Texas Medical Board, what they did was they responded by implementing regulations that make it illegal for doctors licensed in Texas to provide medical advice unless they have physically examined the patient first. And then, of course, there's a million exceptions because that's not really how most medical advice is provided. As a father of two young children, I know for a fact that you get medical advice frequently over the phone, thank goodness. So one form of regulatory response to innovators is targeted, as I suggested at the beginning of my remarks. Literally, somebody brings a better mousetrap to market. The incumbent firms, realizing that they may well be about to get the competitor is going to run them out of business if they don't up their game, they hire a lobbyist and get a law passed making new mousetraps illegal. But the other way that innovation is thwarted in this country is equally important, or perhaps equally important. That is really just the reflexive response of existing regulatory agencies to anything that looks new. And I want to give you one concrete example, again from Texas. It's a case that my colleagues and I at the Institute for Justice worked on. How many of you have seen threading kiosks in the mall? These are people who use a piece of string to remove unwanted facial hair, eyebrows and so forth. Okay, well, this is not really an innovation because it is a technique that goes back thousands of years in South Asia, but it's an innovation in America. Many people have never seen this before. It turns out actually to be a really efficient and relatively painless, not completely painless, but a relatively painless way to get rid of unwanted facial hair and very, very safe compared to, for example, a razor or chemicals. And what happened when people started providing this service in Texas is that the Texas Department of Regulatory, whatever, I forget, TDLR, Licensing and Regulation, that's it, essentially looked at these people and said, well, there's two things going on here. First, you're providing a service without our permission, so that's not good. And second, we don't really have a regulation that fits what you're doing, but we'll just take whatever kind of looks like it might apply. And that happened to be the state aesthetician regulatory regime. There's something short of full-blown cosmetology for people who provide aesthetic services. And even though it was a totally inapt fit, they said, okay, so that's what you're going to have to get is an aesthetician license. That's 750 hours of completely irrelevant training. None of it pertains to removing facial hair with a thread, and there's like maybe a few minutes where they teach you to wash your hands in between customers, and that's essentially all that was relevant. But nevertheless, the TDLR, the licensing body for cosmetologists and aestheticians and other people who provide those kinds of personal services would not relent. So even though there wasn't actually a tailored law on the books, they just pulled off the shelf, whatever looked like it might fit, and imposed it on these people. And we had to sue them all the way to the Texas Supreme Court, where we got a wonderful ruling employing a more robust standard of review than is usually employed in these cases. And that leads me to the conclusion of my remarks, which is this. That was a very unusual ruling. It was a very unusual ruling for the Texas Supreme Court, or frankly for any court, to do the following really simple thing: to hold the government to its proof. So if you're going to come into court and say that a particular activity is dangerous, which the state did, and your training program will mitigate that danger, which the state did, those are empirical assertions. They are either true or they are false. If we cared, we could check. And in Texas, they cared, so they checked. And both statements were false. And so that's why the law was struck down. Now, what normally happens in court is completely different. Normally what happens in court is the court applies what's called the rational basis test, which is simply a judicial version of a rubber stamp that makes no effort to determine if the government's empirical assertions are true, and simply will accept at face value whatever a government lawyer can say with a straight face in court. How do I know? Because it's what I do for a living, is I litigate rational basis cases. As Gene knows very well, one of my favorite cases to describe is one involving Louisiana, which requires a state license to be a florist. And they argue that one of the grounds for why you have to have the license is the physical dangers of unlicensed floristry, which are humorous and completely non-existent, and yet a district court judge in Louisiana upheld the law, partly on the basis of infected dirt and exploding bridal bouquets, which don't happen. It's not a thing. Anyway, so that really becomes a question. Are we going to allow incumbent firms to regulate innovation essentially by influencing regulatory policy in such a way that laws get passed that make it difficult for innovators to bring their product or service to market, and there is nowhere to turn? There is no system. There is no independent check, if that terminology rings a bell. There's no independent check so that when the government makes assertions such as unlicensed floristry is physically dangerous, there's actually a place where you can go, and if that turns out to be false, which it is, then the government has to either come up with something else or leave the innovators alone. The good news is that things are in a bit of state of flux. The Texas Supreme Court decision, while unusual, was not completely idiosyncratic. The Fifth Circuit, which also covers Texas, did a similar thing in a federal case involving state licensing requirement for casket sellers. It's unclear which way this is going to head, but I would submit, and I'll just conclude by saying, it is extraordinarily important for this country whether innovators are able to flourish when they build the proverbial better mousetrap. We have abundant evidence that that will not always happen if we leave these questions up to the regulatory agencies and legislators who hold sway over those decisions. But what we do need is all three branches of government to be involved, and the judiciary has an extraordinarily important role to play so that when the government makes false assertions about the basis for its regulations, that should be something that the judiciary steps in and says, well, then you can't regulate in that area. You have to have a genuine, real, demonstrable concern. If you don't have one, then you need to stay out of the way of these innovators.
Thank you. thank you, Clark. Now we'll hear from Krishna.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here today. I'm Krishna Javadi with Uber. The better mousetrap that we built was ride-sharing.
That's right.
Ride-sharing in its essence is when a rider takes a trip with a driver who's using his own personal car. And we've had tremendous success with ride-sharing in the U.S., and we're in six continents, 60 countries, and 400 cities. So we've proven it's a success around the globe. We found that people like ride-sharing for a whole bunch of reasons. Riders like ride-sharing because it provides a more affordable and easier way to get around. Drivers, we found, like ride-sharing because it fills an important income gap for them. We found that a lot of our drivers actually do it part-time. And I think there's more and more studies coming out that a lot of Americans want an option to work a few more hours a week to supplement their income. And ride-sharing has filled that gap for a lot of people. Cities like ride-sharing because it provides another transportation option. Businesses in cities have thrived, and now that there's a safe way to get out to bars, to restaurants in the evening. And we've started to introduce products such as UberPool that have allowed people to, as we say, excuse my French, get more butts in back seats, and that allow people to share a trip around town, and that reduces congestion. So overall, we've experienced that ride-sharing has been a win-win in the United States. While we think we've improved the mousetrap, we did not invent the mousetrap. For those who are historians and follow U.S. history, around the turn of the last century, the early 1900s, there was a transportation option known as jitneys. So shortly after Ford rolled out with the Model T and cars became more affordable, more and more people were buying them. And what we saw in L.A. was an individual named L.P. Draper. He essentially decided to go down the main streets in L.A. and pick up passengers and charge a nickel. At that point, it's called a jitney nickel. And so, at least as the urban myth goes, that's the start of the craze. At the time, he was competing with streetcars. And streetcars were very expensive to operate. You had to lay the track, you had to operate the cars. So in essence, they were granted almost a monopoly in most cities. And then as jitneys grew, and they grew very quickly in 1915, by the end of that year, there's over 600 in Seattle transporting 60,000 riders a day. It started to disrupt streetcars business. So streetcars do exactly what Clark mentioned. They use their lobbyists, and then they went to local governments, and they lobbied for stricter laws. And in essence, what happened was there became more, there was a light shined on jitneys. And people saw they were not quite that safe. The cars were often overcrowded. They would stop wherever they wanted. They weren't insured. So if there was an accident, the riders were out of luck. So with those fundamental flaws in how a jitney operated, I think it hurt the main upside of it, which was there was a cheap way to get around town. So with these streetcar companies lobbying local cities, they eventually passed a string of laws that in essence hurt the jitney business. There were fixed routes that jitneys had to operate on. They had to surprisingly work a minimum number of hours, 12 or 16 hours, which again, for most jitney operators, they had other jobs. This is a part-time option that they would do before or after work. But most damaging of all, they introduced what in essence became the modern day taxi framework. They introduced a series of regulations on licensing of vehicles and drivers that made it very onerous to get a license and very expensive and very time consuming, and that all but killed the jitney business. So while Mr. Draper started, again, according to urban legend, we don't know for sure, started in 1915, by 1919, you'd almost seen jitneys extinct in every major U.S. city. And soon thereafter, it gave birth to modern taxi regulations. We have a whole slideshow on this, but I guess we don't. That actually illustrates how popular jitneys were. And we use the jitney example because I think it teaches us a lot about how we took a different approach. When we first started operating, so Travis Kalanick and Garrett Camp, they came up with the idea of Uber at a conference in Paris in 2009. They worked on it, and in the core, it was just supposed to be an application that would connect a rider to a driver, and the driver would be fully certificated, which is a livery driver, just another source of trips. But then they came up with a new idea. Once a new iPhone launched that could facilitate a more reliable app, and there was a new service that was launched, which is connecting riders to drivers who are using their personal cars or ride sharing. So what we fundamentally believe was that if you offered a safe product, you insured the trip, you checked the driver's driving record and did a criminal background check, and then you offered a safe platform, which is a cashless transaction. You could see a picture of the driver and you had information about the vehicle, so you got in the right one, that is all you needed to do. So with that, we believe we had a safe product, and we took the view around the country that if the regulations did not explicitly forbid it, and there was a true gray area, we would just launch. and then we would launch, and we would continue to operate, but we'd also continue to work with the regulators. We would have discussions with them, and this is the as the person who's been on the front line for most of these, I think it's tough because our reputation in the press and the public has often been that we don't follow the rules. It's a tough one for us to swallow because there are no rules to follow. So if there are no regulations or laws, well, what exactly are you violating? So we've had tremendous success with it, and in about this time in 2014, we had regulations in one state in California. They had just been passed a few months before that. Now we have it in over 70 in the U.S. So our strategy worked. Launch first, and then engage in conversations. I think it worked because we offered a safe product. Most of the regulations in these 70 jurisdictions that passed, you'd be shocked to find out how closely they are to how we were operating when we launched. Is to fundamentally offer insurance, check and check the driver, both their driving history and then their criminal background. Now as for designing, the challenge I had is what regulatory framework do we actually want to operate under? At the time that we launched, what was most common in the U.S. is what we call a dual licensing scheme. A textbook example is in New York City now, the Taxi and Limousine Commission. They require that our subsidiaries get a license in order to connect riders to drivers. That's called a base license. And of course, they take an 8.5% cut of all the gross in order to have that license. Extremely time intensive to get the license and to maintain it. They also require the driver get a license and license a vehicle from the TLC. It takes upwards of 4 to 6 months to get the license. It costs hundreds of dollars. So in essence, what you're doing is a driver who just has a part-time interest, like a soccer mom wanting to earn a couple extra bucks while the kids are at school, is not going to do that. So we have to come up with a new framework. And the framework that we came up with and we managed to push in most places is you first license us. And you specifically a subsidiary we call Razier LLC. So Razier LLC holds a license. And Razier carries the insurance. And then the regulator lets Razier onboard the drivers. We take care of the background check. We take care of all the other requirements. And what that allowed us to do is the average time to onboard a driver. So by onboarding, I mean from the time a driver expressed interest to when she can take her first trip is less than 2 weeks. And the cost is less than $50. So we've been able to innovate the industry, and that's how we've grown. We have more vehicles on the road in California on a given day than taxis our competitors combined. So our model has proved to work in practice. I think the key things that we've done in addition when we rolled out these regulations was to protect the consumer. We learned that you should let our rideshare company dictate the fare, but the rideshare company has to disclose the fares up front. So we disclose on our website, we disclose in the app, we let riders get an estimate, and we stick to the estimates. So I think that's created a lot of transparency that riders have appreciated. We've also protected competition. We believe that a driver can drive on our app and drive on Lyft's, even if we believe those apps are inferior. They're free to make their own personal choices. And we have not created any barriers to that. So drivers often will have multiple apps on the car just to see who gets a next trip request. And that, I think, has allowed the business to grow as well. So in all of this in the United States, I've taken at least three lessons that I would give to a regulator. And you get invited to these conferences, and especially at NARUC, and they ask you if TNCs, Transportation Network Companies, which is the technical term for ride sharing, is coming to my state, what should I look out for? And these are the three things I tell them. The first is learn the industry. I've been shocked. I didn't believe it when the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick, told me that regulators don't use our product. I said, there's no way. How could someone who's regulating you not use the product? And sure enough, he was right. You go to these conferences, you ask people to raise their hands, have you taken an Uber? Even as frequent as 6 months ago, less than a quarter of the people in the room will raise their hands. So unfortunately, we can't give them free rides due to certain restrictions, but we encourage them to use an Uber. Download the app, request a trip, and see and see what you're trying to regulate. The next is we encourage them, this is part of learning the industry, is one size, it should not be a one size fits all regulation. We are very different than taxis. Taxis have one thing that we don't have, which is a street hail. You can raise your hand on the corner here on Connecticut and call a taxi. You can't do that with an Uber. That street hail it's huge. We would love to have it, but we don't have it. With that street hail, that encourages a taxi driver to drive all around town all day looking for trips. An Uber driver can just sit somewhere and wait for the request. That fundamental difference changes so much about the way that drivers behave and the way the product works that regulators have to appreciate. Also about learning the industry is we'd encourage the local regulators to often look at some documents published by the FTC in the 80s. The FTC did a deep dive of taxi cab regulations, and they found that regulations such as supply caps, which is limiting the number of vehicles or number of drivers, is not helpful, and neither are price ceilings or floors. They don't actually promote business or the industry. And then the next two things we asked them to look out for is how does the product protect the needs of customers? And most customers like the product, and usually what that means for regulators is upfront transparency on fares. And finally is how can the regulation that they impose allow us to innovate? The classic example is the dispute that we're having in Austin right now, which boils down to what kind of background check does a driver have to undergo? We do a name-based background check. We collect someone's information, we run it through thousands of databases. The city of Austin wants us to do a fingerprint background check. What happens with the fingerprint-based background check is, A, it slows down the onboarding process and adds a lot of costs, but fundamentally it's flawed because it's based on arrest records, not convictions. So if I walk out on Connecticut and I'm arrested, that goes on my record, and it'll show up in a fingerprint-based search. Then if I'm exonerated or I'm cleared of whatever I was arrested for, often the local agency doesn't report that. So I still have to work to clear it. On ours, we don't look at arrest records. We actually look at whether you were actually convicted for what you did. So we fundamentally think that ours is better. And the proof is in the pudding. We do this around, we do over 3 million trips a week in the United States. And the number of instances, ours are high profile because they make the press when something bad happens, but you'd be shocked how few it actually happens. So we think that ours works. And we would encourage regulators to allow enough space in regulators for us to actually innovate out there. So with that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Krishna. Threading thing. So turning now to John.
Well, thank you, Maureen, and thank you to the Federalist Society for this opportunity to be here on this panel this afternoon. I'm in the School of Hospitality Management at Penn State on the faculty, and we've recently completed some research on Airbnb, and so I enjoy having this opportunity to present the findings about this fascinating organization. And I think I'd like to use the clicker, if I may. So we've focused on the sharing economy in our research, and it's because we serve the hospitality industry. Our students go and work at companies like Hyatt and Marriott and Starwood, and our stakeholders have been asking us to learn more about Airbnb and the sharing economy in general, but Airbnb is by far the largest player in the sharing economy in the lodging space. So it hasn't been around that long, but it's safe to say that the idea of home sharing has certainly been around for a long time before 2008. So to the extent that Airbnb is an innovation, it's really an innovation in terms of the platform more so than the product. It sounds very similar to Uber in that way. What we noted though in our study is Airbnb is so different than the lodging industry because with traditional lodging options like this hotel, there's a fixed supply every single day, whereas in Airbnb, the supply varies considerably from day to day. But ultimately, Airbnb is a $25 billion company, which makes it larger than Marriott International. And we focused on 12 major metropolitan statistical areas in terms of doing our research. And if people are interested in later, I can talk about method and source of data and things like that. But Unless people are interested, I think I'd like to just skip to our fundamental results. What we found is that there are a lot of hosts on Airbnb, and in fact, most of the hosts are small operators who are renting out one room or a shared room. We excluded from this more comparable to hotels, so individual units, individual apartments, and individual houses. We excluded all of the stuff that people typically call couch surfing, and just included individual units where the whole unit is being rented out, because that's really more comparable to conventional hotels. And what we found is that although most hosts are individual unit holders, multi-unit operators represent about 16.8% of Airbnb hosts, but they generate a disproportionate share of the overall revenue on Airbnb. And in the case of Airbnb, it's about 40% of the revenue on Airbnb is actually generated by more commercial operators who are generating $500 million of the total $1.3 billion on Airbnb. So it translates to a pretty significant sum, and that's between the period of time of September 2014 and September 2015. Another group of operators that we looked at, in addition to multi-unit hosts, were full-time operators. And we found that in these 12 cities, there were just over 2,600 full-time operators, people who were offering units each day or at least 360 days out of 12 months on Airbnb, and they recorded about $378 million in revenue, or a pretty high $142,000 per each host. So these are not small operators. Airbnb will talk about typical operators generating something like $3,000 a year, but that includes a lot of people who are renting out a shared unit. Again, our focus here is on people who are renting out entire units. The full-time operators, although they're not a big share of the overall hosts, they're only about 3% of the overall hosts, they do generate about 28.5% of the revenue. So just like multi-unit operators, the full-time operators are fairly large in terms of the revenue that they generate. Airbnb has grown phenomenally during the time period we studied. From September 2014 until September 2015, we saw 59% growth in revenue on Airbnb. And what we found is it appears that it is continuing to grow. It's so new and it's growing so rapidly, it's a little bit difficult to draw statistics like 12 months versus a prior 12 months. But to the extent those data are available, they show pretty phenomenal growth in Airbnb as well. So, clearly, there's a niche here that has been satisfied, and it continues to grow. What we've noticed, though, is that the growth is even greater than 59% when we look at these larger commercial operators. And specifically, hosts renting out two or more units grew 81% over our study period, and hosts renting out three or more units grew over 87% during our study period. The growth, though, is very different from city to city. And what we've found so far is most of the growth is headquartered in gateway cities. And specifically on the East Coast, most of the growth is in New York and in Miami. And on the West Coast, we've seen the greatest growth in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And in those particular cities, we've seen a great deal of growth in full-time hosts in those cities. So it looks to me like commercial operators are getting into this, and they're using Airbnb as a platform in order to do what they do. So in summary, we do see a number of issues that need to be addressed in terms of Airbnb and home sharing in general. And one would be safety, because I may look like a college professor who wants more federal regulation, but I certainly don't. But I think the point is that there are existing regulations, but that at the present, they're not typically enforced in Airbnb units. And one thing would be pertaining to safety. Hotel operators in each of these cities have fire and life safety standards that they must follow, but Airbnb operators are not required to follow those. There's also security issues. So there's locks and other security issues that hotel operators need to follow, usually based on local regulations, not federal regulations, but Airbnb operators don't follow those. There's also taxes. In all of these cities, there are a variety of taxes, including hotel lodging occupancy taxes. And in most cases, Airbnb operators do not pay those taxes. Those taxes apply to all lodging establishments, including bed and breakfast, by the way. There's also neighborhood issues. So certainly in terms of the effects on the character, as well as just the availability of low-cost housing, those things are issues. And there are some neighborhood groups who are speaking up about that now. And then discrimination. A Harvard University study found that operators on Airbnb were significantly less likely to rent out their units to people with ethnic-sounding names than to people with white-sounding names. And then there's other issues as well. So things like, as I said, there's existing laws, but in many cases there are existing laws related to restricting rentals under 30 days, but in fact on Airbnb most of the rentals are under 30 days. So there are a number of issues to address, and I hope that's something that we can discuss. Thank you.
Thank you. For those of you who watch Silicon Valley, there's a storyline involving Airbnb right now where someone has rented out his unit and can't get the tenant out. So, with that, Peter,
okay.
You get to
if it's okay,
up?
I'm going to stand up
sure.
Because I think I'll be able to see the audience better. Maybe I'll be more comfortable. Well, as the commissioner told you, I frittered away my youth at the FCC, joined it in 81, had a ringside seat on a lot of things that happened there for 8 years, and then, I guess, for the rest of the 35 years, have been following it the last 17 for Intel. The views I'm going to give you today are not necessarily Intel's. I'm giving you my perspective as a longtime follower of communications issues. And I want to make three points today. The first is that increased reliance on markets over that period of time greatly promoted innovation. The key to the success was increased choice. And if anything, it'll be even more important in the future to use this kind of an approach to capitalize the benefits of innovation that surely are in the offing. First, as to increased reliance on market forces, for several decades, starting in the 1970s, even earlier than that, the Commission moved, sometimes in a halting fashion, to open up markets to more and more competition. Some of the examples include open skies for satellite competition, of course, allowing MCI to enter the long-distance market, deregulation of so-called CPE, that's telephone handsets for businesses and home customers, information services, which basically is the internet today, and then deregulating prices and profits on many of those incumbent firms also had tremendous benefits. Eliminating subsidies, dramatically reducing the subsidies, the system was rife with subsidies flowing from local to long distance, business to residential, and so on. And most recently, well, in the last 10 years or so, resisting the temptation to impose very heavy unbundling, price-regulated access to new broadband facilities in the so-called last mile. In the spectrum area, the commission moved to technology-neutral policies, allowing carriers and operators to basically pick their technology and their service, whether or not they provided a particular variation on the existing service, used auctions to determine who gets a license instead of beauty contests or lotteries, which are hard to believe. And repealing the Fairness Doctrine, which happened more than two decades ago. And what I want to say about all of this is, at the time, this was enormously complicated and controversial. And now, I would say, with some high confidence, that it's widely accepted, or at least acceded to, on both sides of the aisle. And the reason is, it worked. It promoted a lot of innovation, and prosperity. And so what was the key to success? If you think about the various things I mentioned, and I won't go into the weeds on those, they were, as I say, very complicated, but fundamentally, they involve giving consumers and competitors a lot more choice. So eliminating restrictions on entry and freedom of contract, reducing or eliminating subsidies, therefore allowing the introduction of new low-cost offerings, and on, again and again, these things involve giving more choice. And that had two big benefits. One that's obvious to this audience, I'm sure, which is if we have voluntary transactions, presumptively, the parties to that transaction deem themselves better off. But one of the things that we don't often recognize enough about deregulation and flexibility and choice is that it imposes a real discipline, which is that all of these players now face the opportunity cost of their previously comfortable world. If you held Spectrum as a cellular carrier and you were happily providing an analog service, the fact that you, or your, even more so, your competitors could adopt a new technology using digital capabilities that would dramatically expand your capacity, that forced you, the capital markets and your profits, forced you to consider those opportunity costs. And so the last point I want to get to is that if anything, all of this has become even more important. The societal gains from these various things, when I was at the FCC, repercussions far beyond what we thought at the time. And we were reasonably disposed to think they were beneficial. But the reason is that the pace of change, the complexity, was far beyond what we expected. Now fast forward to the future, to today, where we're talking about fifth generation cellular using frequencies that are at 60 gigahertz. Most broadcast frequencies are in the 500 megahertz range, so you can kind of imagine. We're talking about licenses that'll be 2 gigahertz wide. A broadcast channel is 6 megahertz wide. You don't have to know much about spectrum, just know a little bit about orders of magnitude, and you can see what I'm talking about. We're talking about the Internet of Things and all these wonderful new apps. Now, that world is so much more complicated, so much more uncertain, so much more risky. The challenge that policymakers and firms, frankly, have is to determine what will work. What was the right solution? When and where and what speed and so on? And I respectfully submit that that challenge has never been greater, or to put it in my terms, the opportunity cost of getting it wrong has never been greater. So if we want, as institutions and as regulators, to exploit the full potential of telecom, and there has been a lot of slippage, we might get into net neutrality. There has been a lot of slippage in the past few years. But if we want to get that full potential, then we need to come up with a better discovery process. And the final thought I'll leave you with is, if we want more innovation, try freedom. Mm. Thanks.
Thank you, Peter. So we have altogether about 15 minutes left, so I'll ask some general questions to the panel, and I'll be sure to reserve about 5 minutes for questions from the audience at the end. So we're here at the Federalist Society, and a question that I have for the panel in general is, many of these barriers are at the state or local level, and what's the appropriate role for federalism in this space, and what role, if any, should the federal government be playing? Whoever wants to jump in on that.
Well, maybe you start first with try to do no harm. That might seem really obvious, but maybe it's not so obvious. and you know, provides space for innovation and experimentation. We hear lots and lots about laboratories of democracy. Sometimes that's a good idea, sometimes it's not. So leave space for experimentation, respect the enumerated and thus finite powers that the Constitution confers upon the federal government. But also I would say, and this I'm sure reflects my background as a public interest litigator, the 14th Amendment was added to the Constitution in order to empower the federal government, and particularly the federal courts, to intervene when states abuse people's civil rights. And one of the most fundamental rights that we possess as American citizens is the right to operate a business, to work for an honest living, and put food on your family's table. And it is absolutely an abdication of responsibility, in my judgment, that the judiciary has essentially written that right off by designating it non-fundamental, appointing as its sole guardian the completely ludicrous rational basis test, and allowing states to serially violate the fundamental American right to earn a living. That is an important role for the federal government that has been largely abdicated, and I would go so far as to say shirked.
Anyone else?
I would agree with the federal government part, particularly in terms of looking at things like shared home services like Airbnb, and to the extent there needs to be federal regulation, I think to a large extent it probably already exists in terms of things like ADA and access. And I would say people in the hospitality industry kind of have a love-hate relationship with ADA, so maybe even that is a bit much sometimes. But I think most of the regulation that's necessary is probably based on the peculiarities of local communities. And again, based on the situation with Airbnb, it would be based on things like what the supply is of economical housing in that particular community. So I think it is largely a community-based issue as well.
No one's going to mention antitrust enforcement, but all right, moving right along. Often these proposals or the state regulations are put forward as being, or sometimes even federal ones, as being necessary for the protection of the public, for health and safety. What's the appropriate way for a regulator to weigh and consider those justifications?
Yeah, if I could. I think that's tricky because most operators, I think, want to offer a safe product because they want to make a profit, and that's how you make a profit. You offer a superior product. I think what often gets wrapped up into words like safety and consumer protection are things that have nothing to do with safety and consumer protection. I offered the example of Austin and background checks as one example, but I think there's. If a regulator gets to understand the business and understand what the business operator is doing to ensure a customer safety, I think there's not much more they have to do. And at least that's been our experience in our business. That said, as I would, there are some things that companies didn't think of that would be good. For instance, there are issues of trade dress. Some regulators wanted us to clearly mark our cars. That's something we had not been doing. Does that promote safety? I haven't seen any science on it, but it doesn't hurt the business. So I would encourage regulators that if they want to have a discussion on safety and consumer protection, let's have an honest discussion that's driven by data and discuss things that actually improve the business.
I would add one thing to that, and this may come as a surprise to some people, but as we at the Institute for Justice documented in a recent study called License to Work, it actually turns out that there are not that many vocations that are universally licensed, doctors, lawyers, a handful of others, but there are many vocations that are licensed only in a subset of states. And if you're a regulator and you care, what you can do is you can look at the states that don't regulate or don't license the occupation and see if any of the parade of horribles that the proponents of the regulation predict have actually come to pass in those states, and you'll be gratified to find out that the answer is always no. And so the data is available, and if you care, you can look.
I would add that the other thing, and this is the point that Clark made, look at how the process in fact works. Who is on these boards who are making these determinations? You don't have to be totally cynical to realize that there's a very strong economic incentive. If you're going to try to keep prices for labor above market rates, you're going to have to somehow restrict supply. And if the board is made up of people in the occupation, you should have some, your red flags go off.
And they're subject to personal liability, I believe, nowadays. Is that right, Maureen?
Well, under the antitrust laws, yes. Yeah.
So. I was just trying to give you a
thank knowledge. You. Thanks for that opening. I appreciate it. A plug for my paper called Brother May I, The Challenge of Competitor Control Over Market Entry. So it's an interesting issue. Often these regulations are put forth as, you know, the need to maintain them is to keep a level playing field. The idea that it's somehow unfair if a new competitor comes in and they have a different, they're subject to a different or lesser regulatory structure. So I'd be interested in people's views on that justification. And Peter, you mentioned net neutrality. I think that idea of levelness and you know, fairness plays strongly into that concept as well.
It does, and frankly, it did throughout the 35 years at the SEC that I know personally. When MCI was permitted in to the long distance market, the first thing that AT&T said is, wait a second, we've got certain obligations that MCI doesn't have. To me, the key is to sort of get beyond the shibboleth and ask yourself, what is likely to happen as a result? What are the costs and the benefits? And one of the common one of the reasons I often found asymmetry better than bad symmetry is that it was politically unstable. So what happened when MCI entered and when competition started undercutting the rate structure is, guess what? The subsidy system was threatened. The price regulatory system was threatened. So even though in some regards there are some equitable arguments that AT&T had back in the day, I think one of the risks of being regulated is that someday regulators may wake up and decide to do the right thing, and you'll be at risk. And I think often it's the case that asymmetry is better than bad symmetry.
Hmm. Yeah, I think if it's interesting in our business, because when I often hear the the phrase level the playing field, it's more that the incumbents want us to do what they're doing. But what they're doing has proven to not work. It led to a bad product. So what does leveling the playing field actually get the consumer, the person taking a transportation option, either a taxi, a livery, or an Uber? So I think leveling the playing field should be what's actually in the best interest of the consumer. The city of Dallas did something that's very interesting that I didn't see coming. Instead of actually carving out a separate category for us, they basically said everybody. They basically threw out all the transportation regs, came out with one uniform structure that everybody can use. And guess what? We're still beating taxi. And so this is the thing where I like what Dallas did. It brought everything down. Everyone's has to play by the same rules. But they at least took our input on minimizing the cost of entry for a driver, make it quicker, make it more affordable, but also ensure some basic safety parameters, and after that, let companies innovate.
Yeah, I would just say that in terms of some issues, I think particularly when it comes to safety and security, I would say that I believe a level playing field makes sense because it's ultimately about protection of consumers, and in the case of shared homes, it's protection of homeowners and neighborhoods as well. So I just wanted to mention that. I think it may be a little bit different with something like Uber versus something like Airbnb, because Airbnb is coming into a space where, and I don't know the taxi business at all, but the hospitality industry has been doing very well. I don't think anybody in the hospitality industry is complaining about the performance of their properties or even in the impact of Airbnb, or even saying that Airbnb or that shared home should go away. So I would say personally, when it comes to things like safety and security, I believe that protecting the consumer and protecting homeowners and having a level playing field does make sense.
So now it's the audience's opportunity to ask questions. There are some microphones out there, or if you don't want to go up to the microphone, you can say the question and I'll repeat it so everyone can hear. Any questions? Yes?
To Mr. Giovanni,
Well, yeah, it's actually, well, the facts are even more extreme. When you say we were actually in the market, had a very large business, we pulled out. We left a large business on the table. So it's not even refusing to enter. And it was just that issue, because we are drawing a line in the sand. And the line in the sand is, it's not as easy as you think it is to actually investigate an arrest record and to prove that you weren't convicted. You're proving a negative. That could take months, and that takes, you actually have to involve a lawyer, in some instances, upwards of thousands of dollars. And again, these are for drivers who are just looking for a part-time opportunity to supplement an income. So what you're essentially doing is it's a tacit way of telling them, just find something else. So we've seen the real world impact to our business and to the driver base. So we felt that this is where we would draw a line in the sand. And to be honest, we doubled down here. We not only the city or council passed an ordinance, we then took it to the people for a vote. We lost the vote, and then that's when we pulled out. So you're correct, there is a technical mechanism to do it, very timely, very costly, and it's just not the right thing to do.
I would add, Lenore, that you know, there's one more point here, which goes to the point I made earlier, which is this is not going on behind a veil of ignorance. If we want to know whether this is an important feature to have as part of, you know, your transportation background check, we can look at all the other jurisdictions where Uber operates and does not do fingerprints, and we can see if there are problems. And the answer is no, there are not problems. So it's a non-problem to which the Austin City Council has come up with a terrible non-solution. And again, if we cared about the data, we could look and consult it, and unfortunately the Austin City Council doesn't apparently care about the data.
And if I could say one more thing, it's a regulation in search of a problem. Yeah. We were already operating. We had a very large business there. There was no issue with it. I've yet to see a report or any data that proves that the way that we were doing it was not working. They haven't come to us with a list of complaints, specific issues, or anything like that. They merely passed a regulation. So, I mean, this is the part where I think we've learned as a company that while we don't like our reputation in the press, we're working on changing that, is you got to fight for what's right. And fundamentally, we believe that this is the right thing to do.
If I seem passionate, I moved to Austin 2 months ago.
So I think we have time for one last quick question. Yes?
Professor O'Neill had a lot of data on the revenue that Airbnb may or may not be siphoning away from Marriott, Starwood, et cetera, but not so much data on the safety and security aspects of it. So one, what are the data? Two, is Airbnb nothing more than Mr. Neely's example of unlicensed eyebrow threading? And three, is there any kind of guiding principle that businesses can be aware of other than just rational basis review at the judicial level for when, you know, a business activity and innovation like Airbnb gets, quote, bad enough that something broader than local regulation is warranted?
Yeah, well, and I actually forgot the first part of your question, but the part I remember, I'll try to reply, and then we can go back to the first part. But I think, you know, in terms of innovation, some of the things we've talked about, I'm not really sure that they are innovative. You know, like the example of hair removal, I think you said it's been around for hundreds or maybe even thousands of years. And I think that's the case with home sharing as well. It's been around for a long time, and I think the platform is unique. But the best parts of Airbnb, and you know if you've been on Airbnb's platform, that it's copied the best parts of hotel central reservation systems. And then, of course, the concept of home sharing certainly predates 2008 when Airbnb and other home sharing services were created. So as far as data, the hospitality industry has been very open with data, and there's public release of performance of hotels and information about hotels. Airbnb is not the same way. It's very opaque, and this is really the first national study to try to scratch the surface. But the source of our data actually was a company called AirDNA, which conducts a continuous search of the Airbnb website. And AirDNA is actually a service for Airbnb hosts, and they provide Airbnb hosts with information about pricing and where units are being offered and at what price and when they're being offered. And so that's actually the source of our data, because AirDNA would not provide us with any data, whether it was related to safety, security, or performance. They have released some data, I should say. They did release about 170,000 lines of data, and allowed a firm by the name of STR to come in and look at it in their office without taking it with them. And it had about 410,000 cells. We had, through our database, actually about 9.2 million cells. So we had a considerably larger database. But again, there is no database that I'm aware of in terms of safety and security. So all of our data related to the performance, the growth, and the pricing.
Thank you. So the afternoon session resumes at 2:15. But before that, would you please join me in thanking our most excellent panel?